everybody. Welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. Thanks for tuning in with me this week. And this week I am talking to Mr. Rafe Nielsen of Browning Firearms. Rafe is the main man over there as far as all things marketing and communications go. So he's got a really big job. He's been at Browning, I believe, over 20 years. And he's just got a really great reputation in the industry, and everybody knows him. Everybody likes him. He's been around a long time, and they put out some awesome content over there at Browning as well as firearms. So I'm really excited to catch up with Rafe today. I hope you guys enjoy this episode. And, you know, I've mentioned it before, so apologies if you've heard this a couple times, and I do mention it again in the episode, but I just recently started working with Browning, and I'm super excited about it. I just actually recently got my new X-Bolt Speed 2 carbon fiber set up, and I got the stock all adjusted the way I like it, adjusted the length of pull and the comb height on it. As well as added the vertical grip, and I got a brand new Leupold VX6 HD 4-24 by 52 on there. So I am pretty much ready to go, and looking forward to getting that thing on some hunts very soon. But in the meantime, guys, if you haven't gone over yet, go to my YouTube channel. I just released about a week or two ago. I just released a episode from my Oregon bear hunt this year. A really fun hunt that I did with Luke Dusenberry and my really good friend Josh Panzica, as well as Ruger Erickson was also there helping us film. And really fun kind of camaraderie, just good fun hunt. And we killed a couple bears. So I, if you go to my YouTube channel right now, you can see the hunt where Josh filled his tag on, believe it or not, a friend of mine texted me the other day. He's like, did you say that right in the description? Yes. It is a verified 37-year-old bear. He sent a tooth in to the Oregon Game of Fish, and they came back to him and told him that bear is 37, which is only 2 years younger than the oldest bear ever recorded in the wild, which is 39. So pretty amazing, really cool episode. And about a week or so from now, I am going to release part two of that hunt where I kill my first bear. He's a nice chocolate boar. I'm estimating to be around 15, but I have no idea. I have not sent his teeth in. I did measure his skull. He was about 17, a little bit under 17 and a half inches. So solid boar. And he was actually chasing a small bear off the cut when we saw him, or when I saw him. And really cool, really exciting episode. It got a little wild, as they usually tend to do with me for some reason. But really excited about this one, guys. And it's presented by Eberle Stocks. So be on the lookout. Go to my YouTube channel. Please subscribe and be on the lookout for both those films. I'm actually quite proud of them. They're really good episodes. And share the show with friends and family. That's the best way to get the word out. So on that note, thank you guys for your support. And enjoy this episode with Rafe Nielsen of Browning Firearms. See you on the next one. All right, everybody, welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. This is your host, Hunter McWaters. It's good to be with you guys as always. And today I am joined by Mr. Rafe Nielsen of Browning. How you doing, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for carving some time out. I know you're busy. And for folks listening, I've talked about it a little bit before, but I'm really excited to be now working with Browning Firearms. I'm actually looking right now at a brand new X-Bolt that I picked up yesterday. It's actually the carbon fiber one. I have the regular X-Bolt Speed 2, but I actually picked up this new one yesterday, and yesterday happened to be my 38th birthday as well.
Well, happy birthday, and we're happy to have you on board as well.
Yeah, man, I'm really excited. Some awesome things coming down the line on the, well, not, well, in works, but also coming down the line on the rifle side and the shotgun side as well, which I do want to talk to you a little bit about because I actually have, as you know, but not too many people know, I'm doing a my first waterfowl slash big game combo hunt episode this year, so that's going to be pretty cool. So, yeah, man, really looking forward to getting stuff in action. I'm planning on heading to the range in the next couple days as soon as I can put a scope on this new rifle. I got a brand new VX6 Gen 2 from my buddies over at Loophold, and I was waiting on that. Now I got that good to go, and that's going to be my, I think that's going to be my rig for the whole season, man. I'm looking forward to getting it in the field.
Well, I think you're pretty well set up then. That's a good set for you on that for sure.
Oh, yeah. And the 300 Win Mag, you know, some people think it's too much gun, but I just like it because you just know you can kill anything in the world.
Yeah, there's a whole conversation to have about caliber selection. Of course, there's a whole world of that conversation, but you just can't go wrong with a 300 Win Mag for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Joseph von Benedict was one of the guys that I listened to that kind of talked me into, you know, I have a couple short actions, but I don't know, just the margin of error. And I grew up shooting 12 gauges, so the recoil doesn't bother me too much. Although I did shoot a shotgun for the first time the other day, 3.5 inch, and I was like, wow, I forgot how much those things kick.
They do. There's a lot more to that, and people give them credit for. So you got to give a lot of credit to the goose guys and the turkey guys that are still hanging in with those 3.5 inch loads. They carry a wallop.
Especially on like over and under, like the inertia guns are a little better. But anyway, man, I do obviously want to talk about Browning and, you know, products and whatnot too, but also just want to get to know you a little bit, man, hear a little about your story and what you do and stuff. Cause I've listened to a couple podcasts you've been on and hadn't heard a whole lot about that. And I just personally would love to get to know you a little bit. So yeah, talk to me about, just you growing up, you know, what your introduction to hunting and the outdoors was like and that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, that's I appreciate that. I've been a lifelong hunter out here. I'm born and raised here in Utah, still here, still in the same county that I grew up in.
Oh, wow. Is that?
It's I'm just here in Davis County of Utah. And our offices are just the neighboring county in Morgan through the mountain range. So I've had a long history and story with Browning here, and it's kind of been a fun journey to get here. And kind of one of the fun stories that sometimes that is interesting is when I was 12, I was hunting doves with my dad, and we were up here in this Morgan County area. And we'd shot a bunch of doves, and then I was carrying an old BSS. If anybody knows that, that's the old side-by-side Browning
nice.
We made back in the 80s. And my dad had that gun, and that's what I was shooting. And my dad happened to mention, he just said, hey, you know, the company that builds that is right here in this valley. And I'm like, no way, there's no way. That can't possibly be, right? We're just in this rural little county shooting morning doves. And he's like, yeah, it is. And so after we got done, we went and had lunch and stuff, he drove me over here to the Browning offices.
Oh,
and,
cool.
You know, back in those days, there was, you know, no security or anything like that. We pulled right into the parking lot, and there was a maintenance guy working. And we got talking with him. He's like, well, come on in. And so he took us in the building. We went through the whole thing. We went into the president's office. We went down to their R&D section. So I have all these great memories as a 12-year-old of being inside the building. And so it was super cool. And so from that day on, I've always been a Browning fan and always dreamed about working up here. And so it started long time ago of having a history here. And I remember getting hired here and walking through the building and going, oh, I remember this. And I remember this. And I remember this. And it's kind of fun. So
that's awesome.
That's the super early days, but getting into the industry, I actually started my hunting career. Yeah. The hunting industry career, at Cabela's, back in their heyday in Sydney, Nebraska. And I had a friend, whose dad ended up working at Cabela's and took a job there, and he called me out of the blue and knew I was in college and looking for an internship, and he called and invited me to come out to Sydney and to do an internship there in the Cabela's offices. So I went out there and spent like 4 months, I think, there in City, Nebraska, and worked in their corporate office and worked on their website as a writer and helped with that whole process there
What
in
kind of
the
stuff were
institute.
you writing?
So back then it was we were doing a lot of buyer's guides and product reviews and that kind of stuff. And so what was really fun is because I was the kid from Utah. There was like three or four of us interns there, and I was a kid from Utah, so they assigned me the Browning account. And so I would call Browning offices and talk to actually they're talking to a guy named Mark Francis, who worked up here forever, who's the clothing business, and interviewed him. And I remember there was an article, I interviewed him and ended up working for him later, after I got hired here. And so yeah, it was kind of fun doing some of those reviews. And one of the other ones I did is on was on Browning safes. And so when I came home from Cabela's, I finished school, got my degree in communications PR, and a copywriter job opened up here. And so I applied for it, and I came up and interviewed for it. And so I submitted all my articles from Cabela's that I'd written about Browning, right? It was in an interview with the head copywriter at the time, and he praised me for this great article I'd written on safes. And I said, "Well, thank you very much." He goes, "Yeah, because you plagiarized it. You took it all from my website." And so, but we had a good laugh about it. But he hired me anyway. So that's how I got here to Browning, was kind of through that avenue of some writing history at Cabela's, and got on here as a copywriter. Did that for a short time, and then I moved over to product development for about 10 years or so, and then moved from there back to the advertising marketing side of the business about 11 years ago. So I've been here 21-ish years and had a great career so far, and looking forward to another 20, I hope, for sure.
That's awesome, man. 'Cause you don't see that a lot anymore, just in my short tenure of the last 4 or 5 years working with brands. I mean, and granted, it's usually the younger guys, but you go to the Hunt Expo 1 year, and you're like talking to somebody in marketing, and come back the next year, oh, they're over here now, and like people are just like always moving back and forth. So it's pretty cool to see like that, and it almost feels like it was like your destiny to work at Browning, just being like a hometown guy and all that story there.
Yeah, it's cool. I got sitting here in my office now, and I can look out the window, and I can see the hillside that I was hunting mourning doves on back, when I was 12 years old. I can literally see the mountain, the little hill that I was on. So yeah,
That's cool.
it feels that way. And we have a great history here at Browning for people staying. Our average age here is super high in terms of seniority and how long people have been here. We retire people out of this building at 35, 40, 45 years pretty commonly every year. So we have people who come and stay forever, and that obviously adds to great culture that we have here at Browning, and a great place to work. We're up here in a mountain valley away from everybody. We have snow-capped mountains all around us. I got turkeys outside my window right this very
Oh,
second.
cool. Oh, that's awesome.
That we look at, I can see the ski resort that the Olympics were on out the other window. So we're pretty blessed to be here. We have great facilities. We have shooting facilities that are here on site that we can utilize, and so it's a great place to be. We have it's great culture, great people to work with, and I think that's why nobody leaves this place, is that we really have created a place where once you get here, you don't want to go anywhere else, because it's the best place to be.
That's good. And that says something about a company, how they treat their folks. Seems like, I've seen it seems like Leupold is kind of like that way as well. Like folks that get in there stick around for a while, and that's really good for guys like me, interfacing and working with brands. Knowing, hey, this is an organization that takes care of their people, that likes to build long-term relationships. And because in my position it happens, man. Like you got something going with the company, and then guy leaves and they call you, hey, new guy in town, like we're and you got to start from scratch again, so. And that can be tough. So it's nice to see companies like that where you can feel like you can build a long-term relationship with.
Yeah, I think momentum goes a long way for us. Not just for us as a company, but for an industry as well. I think that there's I think the momentum and the long-term relationships that are built really adds to authenticity. It leads to people believing in you from a long time. Like we sell very expensive products, right? Like we don't hide from the fact that our products are $1,000 products or more. And so you don't get those flash sales, you don't get those instant buys necessarily. It's somebody that's thought about it for a while, right? And so when you have a while to think about a purchase, you're going to go through a lot of thought processes and think about all the ways that you've been influenced by that and how you get to that point. And you do that subconsciously, of course, right? But if you're accustomed to watching the Outdoor Channel or Sportsman Channel, whatever it is, or YouTube series or Instagram feeds, whatever it is, having something consistently shown to you that is showing success, showing values and those types of things that you can connect with, it makes a big deal. It it it's it it, it breeds confidence in the consumer, knowing that there's a long-term story and history behind that product and that brand that has stood the test of time. And I think that speaks not just for our brand, but I think for the industry as a whole. Anybody who has those feelings has come to there because of the authenticity of it. You just can't fake that in this industry. You might be able to fake it somewhere else, but this industry is one of those that if you're not authentic and if you're not part of the I don't know what to call it, the in crowd, right? But I think the in crowd in terms of being an expert or the in crowd of being authentic. I just don't think that you have a voice that is of any value, and I don't think consumers look to that inauthentic voice to move the needle for them. And so I think that a lot of that just kind of breeds off of how you treat people, how you treat your customers, how you treat your pro staff, and that long-term story that is just bred for a long time. I'm a perfect example of that. 12 years old, man. And when I became a huge fan and just have grown with that. And I don't think our consumer has any real different journey for the most part, is that they've known us for a long time. And so we think very highly of that mentality for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, obviously Browning is like, I mean, I look at it as, kind of one of those like iconic brands. Obviously it's within the outdoor kind of niche, but like I, so it's not like a Pepsi or something, but I look at it like, within our context, for sportsmen, I mean, it's one of those iconic brands. And I mean, on the military side too, with like the BAR and the BMG and all the other, big, whatever you'd call it, developments that has come out of Browning. So, and then, yeah, I personally have a history with it too. I gotta turn my video here on a second. I wanted to show you something, but, can you see me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, my dad just gave me this. It's like a,
Oh, look at that superposed.
yeah, it's like a night. I looked it up, the serial number. It's from like the early 70s, I think. Pretty cool Superpose. Because my dad's been a Browning guy since I can remember. He's a huge Browning fanboy, so he was like so excited also when I started talking to you guys. But and then he gave me this one too recently, Satori.
Corey, yep.
So I just wanted to show you those. But
That's awesome.
those are a couple of my favorite guns. Although I gotta say, I when it comes to like waterfowling and stuff, I am definitely an auto gun guy, but I do love those guns. And like and going back to like, so I got my start, shooting doves as well, which is gotta be one of the most underrated hunts like in the world. Like a good dove shoot is still like one of the most fun things ever. And just the like my memories of it, like my dad taking me out there before I could even have a gun, have like a BB gun or whatever. And my dad taking me out there, and then just like, it's warm, you can do it with friends, like it's more relaxed, and if it's a good shoot, it's an awesome hunt. You still hunt doves sometimes?
It actually is one of my favorite things to do as well. That is at the top of my list. A good dove shoot is about as good as it gets for me. I for the same reasons, right? It's low pressure, lots of fun, good weather. I like the fact that it's a great opportunity to take out a Satori, an over and under. You can shoot sub gauges at them and get a chance to shoot those. You don't have an opportunity to shoot over and unders as much unless you're doing clays, right? But you take them pheasant hunting, you shoot twice. But doves, you could go and use those really cool guns. And so I love, yes. So the answer is yes, I love dove hunting immensely.
Nice, man. Yeah, it's another thing too. I was mentioning when you're talking about your story. It kind of reminds me of some ways of how I ended up in the media kind of side of things, because I grew up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and I don't think I became aware. Well, yeah, and I knew about. I don't know if you've ever heard of this show, but there's a old used to be popular show called The 700 Club, with Pat Robertson, and
Yeah.
okay, yeah, so that's the Christian Broadcasting
Yeah.
Network, and they're based in Virginia Beach, and I remember going there one time as a kid, but it's like a huge television studio. It used to be like huge in the 80s and stuff. It's kind of declined a little bit as in popularity, but yeah, and then as a young man, I was kind of searching what I wanted to do, and make a really long story short, I ended up getting a job as a cameraman on the traveling camera crew at CBN.
Awesome.
And it's the same thing. It's got this big, huge, giant campus there, and they have a college camp and a giant studio, and it's just interesting how I decided I wanted to get into media, and then figured out that CBN was. And I also wanted to do something ministry related, and I found out that CBN was like in my hometown, and it was like, whoa. So it just, when you were telling that story about Brownie, it kind of reminded me of that. That's pretty cool.
Oh yeah, it's been a lot of fun to be up here and have that kind of personal connection for sure.
Yeah. And then I think the first, I think the first rifle I ever shot was my dad. He's still got, my dad's got a BL-22, beautiful
Yeah.
little, do you guys still make those?
Absolutely. Yeah, we sure do. One of the legacy products that we still make,
That's a
which
really
is
fun little
what
gun,
it's
and
worth.
that's my first my son. That's the We had him shooting that the other day, so
Yeah.
there's a little multi-generational thing.
I've had my kids out shooting mine as well. And so, yeah, it's kind of fun to start building up those collections of guns you're going to pass down to your kids eventually.
Oh yeah, when were you, like, what years were you writing at Cabela's? Because I remember looking at those things and just drooling over the magazines. And even when, like, I'm sure you remember, they came out like with like a hardbound book. Do you remember
Yes.
that? Like a giant catalog.
So my year, I was there in 2001,
Okay.
and I was in the internet department actually, and
Okay.
was writing and building up their website. So they were going from a very rudimentary web platform to a launch of a new enterprise system. And so I was in the process of working on that project for them. And a matter of fact, it was kind of funny because I came home just before 9/11 actually, and that was they were supposed to launch their website on 9/11, ironically, and then they got delayed.
Interesting.
But yeah, so it was 2001, and it was all their new web development. So we were building up all the content for their web.
Wow, okay, so you were kind of on the forefront of the internet over there.
Yeah, sort of. I was actually doing HTML coding, and I had no idea what
Wow.
I was doing. So somehow it worked, but I've forgotten all of it for sure now. That is not it's not my bailiwick anymore. But yeah, back then I was in the back end trying to code stuff and learning all that whole process too.
Yeah. So what was like the I guess the genesis of, or did you dream of working not only in the outdoor industry, but in kind of the marketing side of things? Was that something you were led to, and what kind of led you that way?
My degree is in communications and PR, so the idea of being in that industry as a whole always interests me. I love the writing aspect of the business, and writing in general. If I had to go back into some other career, I think I'd try to still stay in that area because I've always enjoyed the written word and the pictures that go with it, photography and those types of things. So
Cool.
I've always enjoyed that piece of it, and it's just kind of ingrained. I did a bunch of writing in college. I wrote for the newspaper in college there. I actually joined a political campaign and was writing all their political ads
Oh,
prior to coming
cool.
on up here. So I'd always just kind of been in that area of business. And so the copywriter thing when it came up was right in the mix of what I wanted to do for a career, and I was able to kind of slide in and take that job and go from there.
Cool. So what does your job look like now? From a grand scale, but also kind of like on a day-to-day scale.
Yeah, so from a grand scale, here in the marketing department, we run anything that is the grand scale of anything you see from us comes from our offices here. So whether that's if you're at a show, like a trade show type of a thing, whether you're seeing an ad in a magazine, a commercial on TV, if you're reading editorial in magazines or YouTube videos, anything that Buck Mart touches that you see from Browning, short of being the actual product at retail, is coming out of our offices here
Wow.
in Browning. So we handle the website, we handle all of media, all of packaging, all of ads, print, digital, commercial ads, our e-com business. So anything that's forward facing that a consumer may see is coming from us.
So that Buck Mark sticker I had on my Chevy Silverado when I was 16 came from you guys.
It did 100%. That's our world. So yeah, anything short, like I said, anything short of the actual product in retail, that's what's coming out of my office here and our team, and we're pretty proud of the work we do. It's a big job in terms of how much we touch.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on for us, and I'm oftentimes jealous of single focus companies because they only have to worry about one thing, and we do have a lot going on for us here. We have a large breadth of line of product that we have to touch on, and so everybody's very busy and trying to be an expert in all things, and that's the challenges and a lot of opportunities for growth to learn all that new stuff.
Yeah, for sh sure. And forget, I know I keep doing this, but I just thought of one more thing. My
Yeah.
first bow was a Browning Micro Midas, and I was a sniper with that thing, man.
Oh yeah, we had a great run with the archery equipment in the 80s and 90s and even early 2000s. We actually the bow plant, those were all built in, is just up the street from our offices here. And when we got out of the archery business, it got licensed off to PSE,
Oh,
and they
okay.
for the last few years there in the early 2000s, and then they gravitated away from that. But we had a great run in the archery business for a while. We've
Yeah.
had great runs in all kinds of. It's not only call them side businesses, but maybe other projects of archery, and we've done camping and bicycles and golf clubs, and we've done a lot of things over the course of the history of Browning. Tennis rackets, and one of the fun things we've done, I know it's kind of going sideways from your point, right? But I always like to point it out when we get into this
No,
topic that
yeah.
we built at one point in time, we were building pole vaults. And
Wow.
we hold the record, or did back in the 60s and 70s. We had several gold medals in the Olympics and world records that we
Wow.
held with Browning pole vaults. So
That's crazy.
we've done a lot. And so we keep that history of doing a lot. We have a lot of products here today, and it's just different now. But we still have always had that long, long story of building a lot of stuff and being everywhere present in the outdoor industry.
Yeah, I mean, you guys do have a really wide variety of products. Definitely more focus, I'd say, probably in the, like you just said, in the outdoor industry now. But even as you can tell just from me talking and my little anecdotes of everything I remember growing up with Browning, very much ingrained. But so you must have like a pretty good sized team you lead, huh?
Yeah, it's a modest sized team, right? But we have a smattering of everybody that kind of touches points where we need. We have a great web tech team that handles all of our back end of driving our website. We have an enormous website. It's a huge site with tens of thousands of pages and enormous amount of traffic goes through it. So we have a great tech team that builds out that side of it. I have a great media team with the photographers, videographers, editors, and media folks. I got great PR people working for us that handle the media on the outside. We've got copywriters still on staff here, as well as graphic designers that do both print design as well as digital design. So we have it's a modest sized team, but we kind of touch all the high end points. We outsource very little of our work. We want to keep it all in house, and so that it meets our standards and our quality, and we keep some quality control of what that looks like. And so, it's a great team. They do a great job. They stay very busy, and we're pretty proud of them.
Yeah, I was just like flipping on the TV the other day and I saw Shondi. I was like, ah, I know that lady.
she is awesome. She heads up so
She's all
much.
over the place.
She really does. She does about four jobs, I've tried to relieve some of her duties, but she won't give anything up. So she's her own worst enemy. But yeah, she handles all of our media. She handles our shows. She handles our social media.
Wow.
She handles the PR side of things. And so she's got her hands in just about everything. And she won't give anything up. She loves it so much, and she does such a good job that I'm pretty reluctant to take anything from her.
Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly.
So, okay, what is your favorite and least favorite parts of your job?
Oh man.
Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah, those are tough. The favorite part of the job is honestly the fact that we make a difference, right? When I hear stories of people who saw something we did or is an influence to buy something, I take great pride in that. There's something about that, knowing that what we're doing here to market our product, to send it out there to the consumer to see, may influence somebody's buy and career. And just like your dad was influenced at some point in time, and he's passed it on to you, and that generation goes on and on and on. And we take that very serious. In my spot of, it makes a difference. If you can make somebody a Browning guy young in age, we'll keep them for a very long time. I always point out to folks, I attend the youth trap shooting national championships, the SETP
Oh, nice.
championships in Ohio, and I go to that nearly every year. And it's just because it's one of the most faith enduring exercises. You can go out there, you see these 4,000 shooters. It's the largest trap shoot in America. And a bunch of kids that are out there shooting guns and toting flags, and it's pure Americana. They're just these solid kids, but they come in and they talk to us about our guns, and they've done the research, and they've been influenced by their dad. And they come in and say, "I'm shooting my dad's old Satori, and I'm trying to talk my grandpa into buying me a new one for my league." And it's super fun to see how that influence has taken place and how you can affect people and what they buy and what they use. And it's not so much that, like, that's great for business, right? But we always say, when you're using one of our products, and one of the things that we try to instill upon product managers and those kinds of things is, you're buying our stuff not because it's out of necessity, not because it's just anything other than,
Right.
when you use our stuff, you're going to go do something fun, right?
Yeah.
The purpose of that is that we're influencing your life for the better. You're going out and you are doing the thing that makes you a better person, whether you're hunting or shooting, whatever it is. That's your escape from the real world, if you would. That's where you find joy and you find happiness. And that's what we're here to do. And if we're building product, and I'm influencing people to buy our product, where they're going out and they're having the time of their life, well, then I'm doing something right, right? And I'm a part of something that's bigger than me, and it makes a difference in people's lives. It's game changing to their experience. And if they're having those game changing experiences, and I'm providing a product and a message that they get to associate with, that's the best part of the job. So that's a long story to say that's the best part of the job.
No, and just real quick, just to jump in there, I mean, some people from the outside might look and or, hear you say that and be like, what is he talking about? Like, it's just a hobby. But like, honestly, it's not just a hobby. Like, and that's why, like, I mean, going on my first backcountry hunt literally changed my life. And that's why I'm sitting here on this podcast right now talking to you, because I did that hunt. And yeah, I mean, maybe if you're a casual hunter or, you go on, one or two, I don't know, I'm not going to pick out any specific type of hunt because I'm not going to like call anybody out, but like it doesn't have to be life changing. It can just be like a hobby and just go out for fun. But like, especially some of the stuff that I do, like, and we do, and a lot of your customers do, is life changing, aspirational adventures that, I mean, can, and in my own life, were a catalyst for me to get in shape and to eat healthier and to, as cliche as it sounds, you know, go after my dreams and realize that life is short and, this is my passion and this is what I want to do and I'm going to go for it and it's not going to be easy. And I might quote unquote fail, but hey, I'm going to go for it. So it can be a life-changing thing for people.
Yeah. And I think the argument goes for both of those causes of those who wrap their head around it and that becomes an identity. I think both in you and I both kind of will claim that our identity is wrapped around hunting. That's who we are. That's how we're known amongst our family and friends. And certainly from that standpoint, it's life-changing. But even for the casual guy who simply for a few minutes on a Saturday can go out and break a few clays in the back 40 or to sit in a tree stand for a half a day, and that's his escape for the year, right? And
yeah,
he gets to put a smile on his face for a few minutes.
And have some connection to nature and God and whatever else.
That counts, right? That
for
counts
sure.
As making a difference in somebody's life. And that sounds dramatic, but really, if you look back on it, the happiest times are sometimes the simplest times. And we look at that. And if you sit in a tree stand for a half a day and get to smile and not be at work, you kind of go, oh, this is all right. This rejuvenates me to go back and be a better dad and be a better father and be a better employee and contribute to my community or whatever that is. It's where you regenerate. And even if it's a half day a year or whether it's 100 days a year, you know, we aspire to create an environment, a product, a message that people gravitate to that they can check that box, whether great or small, and at the end of the day, they should be smiling when they use our product.
100%. Yeah, well said. That's true. I mean, you don't have to go on a 10-day backcountry hunt to enjoy the benefits of getting out there, getting some exercise, getting some UV light in your eyes, getting some green time, like time in the nature. Like you said, even in micro doses, it still is a positive like impact on people's lives, just getting in God's creation.
Yep, 100%. And we love being a part of any part of that story.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been in the industry a long time, like from the dawn of the internet, basically. How, I don't mean that in a bad way. How have you seen the industry change? And what do you think is good? And what do you think is like, it kind of makes you a little nervous?
Yeah, another great question. I think it has become far more complex in every avenue that you speak of. Complex, I'll start with products, where I think just in general, products have become so much better over the last course of, let's say, 20 years versus the previous 70, right? You had a huge revolution at the John Moses Browning timeframe where you're changing the way guns are built. But then from there to the last 20 years, it was pretty static, I would make an argument. And then the last 20 years, I think technology has really ramped up for everybody, where performance of your product is substantially greater than it was in your dad's time. I mean, I started hunting in combat boots and blue jeans and a fatigue jacket, right? And we were shooting 3-9 scopes and 30-06s, right?
Yep.
And that's not that long ago. And today, man, you know, there's $500 boots you put on, and you got your full gear set up and rain gear and high performance goods, and then you have rifles and optics and ammunition now that and new exciting calibers that have fundamentally increased the odds of success. Where accuracy has been increased dramatically. Your gear that you put on helps you stay in the field longer. I just think that piece of it becomes very complex if you want it to be. Not going to be as simple as you want to as well, but we've added so much element and so much technology for the good. That part of it definitely has changed over the last, watching it in 20 years. When I'm putting my kids in, when I take them hunting, I laugh and go, oh my heavens, I can't imagine having this kind of equipment and this kind of opportunity, right? I never had that. But I think that that's all for the good and all for the better that way. In terms of the marketing and how the messaging of the industry goes, it certainly is changed from being very simplistic, magazine ad buys and newspaper ad buys, and then maybe, a handful of TV shows where you get a commercial on. And that's what I started with 20 years ago, was basically those avenues. And it was very simple to make your message and get your product out there, and your message out there. That's where they would see it. Now, there's a million places where you can get your message out. There is all of social media, there's all of YouTube, there is television still, there's still magazines, there's influencers, there's grassroots efforts. There's just a million ways in which people digest a message from a company. So trying to identify where to go at, I think is very complex.
For
And
sure.
while challenging, it certainly is a lot more exciting. We get to do a lot more fun things in terms of creating content, ads that we are able to build, dynamic stuff that we get to showcase what our products do. We got a great designer here that's doing some great animations that really does help showcase what our product does for us, and that you don't get to do when we were doing newspaper ads. So while it's complex in terms of trying to get the message to everybody, it's certainly a lot more fun. And it does add a bunch of stuff to it. So that part of it, I think, has been a big change, of where people see us and how we can talk to our consumers. We're able to talk to them directly. I mean, we have a Facebook page of 2 million people, right? And over 500,000 people on the Instagram. And so we're able to send our message more direct than we've ever been able to do before. And that part is fun. So we can talk directly to our consumer, and they're coming to listen to us, and we know we have an engaged audience, where you didn't have that 20 years ago. You're putting an ad in a newspaper hoping that somebody opened up that Saturday section and saw you. And so there's a lot of change in being able to talk to our consumer. With that, I think that adds a lot of challenges to the industry, because there's a lot of, I mean, at the end of the day, there's a lot of bad players out there, and it can give hunting a bad eye that is broadcast to a larger audience. You get a bad actor out there that posts some inappropriate pictures or offensive pictures online that way. It certainly can give the industry a black eye, and we've seen several examples of that. And so it does open up. You have advantages of doing good with it, and there's opportunities for people to take advantage and hurt the industry if they behave incorrectly. And like I said, there's been several advantages of that. You have to watch that and pay close attention to make sure you isolate yourself from those bad messages that get broadcast. But it does clean up the industry. It's told and taught our fellow members of the hunting community to act right and behave correctly. And we've seen a better focus on why we hunt, and better stories, I think, across the board. I think, even though there's a challenge in that aspect, I think it has brought a better view of hunting to the broader community. And I think we've done a really good job as a community to broadcast why hunting is important. What about conservation, eating healthy meat, connecting with families, being out there and connecting with nature. There's just so much of that good message that is out there that I think overshadows any of the bad and challenges that are out there. I think we've been able to historically weed those guys out, and focus on a lot better message, for everybody to kind of follow. So it's a challenge. I think we're very conscious of it. We watch it. I watch it very closely, and certainly, it's one of those things that's very much on the forefront, but I think we're winning that battle, across the board.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of like, with great power comes great responsibility. And like you were saying, there's so much more opportunity to reach a wider audience, not just within our niche of the outdoor industry, but to other folks. And this is where I see, and like you're saying, you got to be careful to represent hunting authentically and well, because I think we have a huge opportunity as hunters, maybe more so than ever to reach those folks who, you know, there's a whole kind of group of guys my age and the 25 to 40 range who, are into the outdoors, into, you know, sports and stuff like that, maybe aren't hunters, they're kind of that middle ground that could be swayed either way. They could see a really well-told story that's respectful of the animal and tells, you know, the whole story of why we hunt, not just for killing. And they could be like a guy on my worship team at church just this weekend. I was like, hey, man, I watched one of your videos. Like, yeah, it was really cool. Like, I didn't think I would really like it, but it was, like, really cool. Like, I would like to try hunting sometime. And we can reach those guys and change their mind, because for so long, all they've seen is the Hollywood version of hunting, which is always negative and always completely wrong. We have an opportunity to reach those guys. Whereas, you know, like you said, if we don't weed out some of the folks that are not doing what they're supposed to be doing or not representing it right, you can take that same guy who was on the fence and might be interested now in trying hunting, and you can put a horrible taste in his mouth and make him an evangelist for why hunting is bad, you know?
Oh, 100%. And, I think recruiting new hunters and engagement is obviously super important to keep up our numbers up and our participation up. But I think even more important is being just advocates to those that they may not want to hunt, but you at least want them on your side, right? You want them as part of to support you socially. They may not engage in it. They may not want to engage in it. But certainly can look and see what we're doing and go, oh, I understand why you do that. And I'm not against it.
Exactly.
And I think that's even a more important block of society that we need to pay attention to than just recruiting new hunters. And I'm not against it, right? But I think that we focus a lot on recruiting hunters. But a lot of our what we should be focused on is setting the example to those who don't hunt or don't want to hunt, but can look at us and go, you know, those guys are good guys, right? When there's the times are down, you know, I can count on that guy because I know he's got a generator, he's got a boat, he's got, right, like, you know, there's all of that that you can point to where people can look at you and go, hey, if there's a disaster, I know where I'm going. I hear that all the time, right? With people know I got my own guns, of course, and have equipment, and those who don't participate in that, they look to the hunting community for, I don't want to call it survival, but I think a lot of times there's a lot of national disasters that happen out there, whether it's flooding from hurricanes or whatever, and you see all the duck boats from Louisiana rolling out there and rescuing people, right? And so there's all those stories that we get to tell and just broadcast the better message of hunting is good and it's positive and it helps communities and it helps wildlife and it's a conservation story and it's good for society to have us out there and to portray that message and have a quote unquote a voting block or a community that supports us is every bit as important as actually recruiting actual hunters.
That's so true. And I haven't really thought of it from that perspective, but yeah, that is very true. Especially when, you know, the barrier to entry for hunting is relatively high, I will admit. And, but you're seeing a lot of decision making. I don't think it's necessarily right, but a lot of wildlife decisions are happening at the ballot box. So that's why what you just said is super important.
Oh yeah. I mean, you look at I don't get too political, in my position, but you do look at like a place like Colorado, right? Where, they lost a huge battle with wolves and it came down to just the view of hunting. And unfortunately that community of Colorado, sways on the other side of that whole thing. Whereas if you were here in Utah, that would never fly. I bet we have the same number of hunters, but we have a more understanding community, I think, here in this state that we get the favorable view that actually, you know, helps us a whole lot better. So yeah, it makes a difference to our day-to-day enjoyment of the outdoors is how the public perceives us.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about products here. I'm holding right now a X-Bolt Speed 2. Like I said, I picked it up yesterday on my birthday. This one is the carbon fiber barrel, and it's got a nice big aggressive muzzle brake on it, and this thing is sweet, man. I can't wait to get my scope on it and get out the range. And one of the things that is really cool about it is this stock you guys made, that you get kind of a lot of the features you would get out of like a custom chassis or stock, but it's completely like customizable. So, some guys like a more traditional like sporter style grip. I personally have gotten used to a bigger and more vertical grip, which you can interchange. It comes in the box with two grip styles. The comb height you can change, and I also just this morning took off the back of the buttstock, and it's really easy to do. It's just like a little screwdriver, normal like Phillips head. Take that thing off, add some included inserts, because my length of pole is a little bit longer than standard, and you can put some inserts in there, adjust your length of pole, or shorten it for a smaller shooter. So pretty cool stuff, man. Like, and there's definitely more to it that you know more about than I do. So, talk to me a little bit about this, Speed 2.
Yeah, I know. I appreciate it. You kind of hit the high points. When we changed over from the original X Bolt to the X Bolt 2, now last year, we set out to, obviously make a better gun, which I think we did. But I think even more important to that process is that we set out to build the gun that made you a better shooter and made you a better hunter. And that was an important aspect to me as we started that process of, what are we doing? What do we want to do? And we really wanted to make it so that it made you better. And part of that is being able to get a gun that fits you. And that's where the Veritech stock that you're referring to comes from is we wanted to have something that people could fit into. You go to a gun store and you grab a gun and you put it up to your shoulder and you grab another one, you grab another one, and you end up taking home the one that feels best, right? And sometimes you take one home that you don't like some of the feature sets, and then you're disappointed at the end of the day. So this gives you an opportunity to know your feature sets. You have an excellent trigger, an excellent bolt throw. Accuracy is well defined from our standpoint. And then you look at the fit and you go, well, I wish it had a little higher comb or a little longer length of pull or whatever that is. And you now know you can take that home and build that gun out to fit you like a glove. And if a gun fits you correctly, you are going to instinctively be a better shot, a better hunter. Everything comes together better for you. And that's the big piece of
Definitely.
it. So those stocks, as you mentioned, we have length of pull adjustments on those stocks. We have comb adjustment, we have grip adjustments, and all those things make a huge difference in when you throw that gun up, are you looking straight through that scope? You don't have to cant your head. Your hand to trigger ratio there that makes that comfortable where you're on the trigger naturally. All of that brings about a better experience and a better shot and a better hunting experience for you. And that was the big piece of it. And I think our guys really took something else into consideration on that is that instead of trading, you can trade adjustable stocks all day long, but we wanted to do it in a way that still felt traditional and it didn't look ugly and cumbersome and awkward. A lot of those, adjustable stocks do that. And so one of the things I was really impressed with their design work was, especially in the length of pull portion of it, is all that is in the center of the stock. And so you pull the stock in two, you make your adjustments in the center of the stock, and you put it back together. And so it doesn't have these awkward spacer looking effects on the back end of it next to the buttstock. Still looks very sleek and traditional and modern and without looking cumbersome. And I was really impressed with how they went about that whole process. And like you mentioned, it's very easy. It's easy to make those adjustments. I adjusted one just the other day with the comb. I needed the comb just a little bit higher and was able to, just one little screw in the back of it, and I was able to adjust the comb the way I needed it to be, and off I went. And so makes it really easy. And you have the confidence. And I guess that's the part of it. You have the confidence to know that you can take that gun home, make it fit you, and now you have a gun that is your gun and not just something that we've cobbled together on our side. So I'm really impressed with how we've come with that design. And then, you take it to the next step, and if you need it to fit your kid or a buddy or whatever it is, you can make those quick adjustments and it can fit anybody. And one of the things I noticed that some guys doing, which I hadn't thought about either, is We buy these guns and shoot these guns, and the convenience of wearing t-shirts and that kind of stuff. And then you don't realize that once you throw on a big 401 parka and go up to a tree stand,
It's true.
those guns fit you differently, right? So
Yep.
if you are going to do that, you know that you can take a spacer out, and that gun's going to fit you better in your clothes. So if you really want to get macro into it, you have those types of opportunities to really fit, based upon your hunting style. If it's cold and you're bulky, you can shorten that length of pull and have a better fitting gun during that season, and then lengthen it back out when it's warmer again. And so there's just a lot to it, and that's the part that we focused on, was making it a better gun and a better user experience.
Yeah. And other thing, the trigger is really good on these things. And also something I really like that I don't hear a ton of people talking about, I really like the magazine. I like having magazines that I can take out because I like to carry an extra one with me. But at the same time, sometimes some magazine designs, like I'm always concerned when I put the thing on my pack, it's going to fall out. But this thing goes in there flush. With the bottom of the, I guess it'd be the receiver. I don't know. I'm not like technical here, but
Stock, yeah.
yeah, it goes in there flush. It clicks in nice and tight. And I tested it, and you can interchange them so you can pick up extras. And so I really like that.
Yeah, the stock is, I mean, the magazine's actually a unique feature, and we don't talk a lot about it, but there's two actually things really cool about that magazine that, one, it functions well and it fits flush and it's pretty and clicks in nice and all that, which you mentioned. But there's two other things about the magazine which are kind of incidental, I guess, to some. But one, the way that we have it created is where you block the movement of the cartridges inside that magazine. So oftentimes in magazines, especially Dropbox magazines that fall out that way, when you shoot, the recoil of the gun to the shells in the magazine does move, right? They're movable, and it can damage the tip of your bullets.
Oh,
And so
yeah.
in a traditional magazine, and you shoot plenty and lots of recoil, you can see damaged tips from those magazines. So we have a shoulder in that magazine that prevents those tips from hitting the front end of the magazine during recoil. So it
That's
always
cool.
preserves the integrity of the tips. And then the other piece of it is that it's a rotary magazine, so it's a single feed. It's not an offset, and so you have a much more reliable feeding system where you're not coming from a side, having to straighten it out and throw it back into the chamber. It's coming straight in line, and so you always have a far more reliable feeding system because it's a single feed on that rotary and not an offset. And so that's made a
Interesting.
big difference from, back in the A-bolt days when we did that, was an offset, and a lot of other guns that are offset feeds. A straight feed is far more reliable.
Yeah, and I've had a rifle with the offset magazine, a couple of them, and I have had feed issues a lot, actually. Now that you mention that. And that's pretty cool. I didn't even know that stuff. And it just kind of speaks to, a lot of companies just be like, okay, magazine, throw a magazine in there. You guys actually obviously put quite a bit of effort and thought into making the best magazine you could. So that's just kind of the attention to detail that is pretty cool about your products.
No, I appreciate
Talk to me real quick. We're coming up on time here. I don't want to keep you too long, but talk to me real quick about shotguns because as I alluded to earlier, I haven't. I am still shooting the same shotgun that I got in high school, which is cool. Like I don't mind that, but definitely need a new one at some point. And I got this episode. It's pretty cool. I'll just plug it real quick. It's a collaboration episode that I kind of lined up with Ducks Unlimited, and I'd been antelope hunting a couple times out in Wyoming, and always noticed. There's like a lot of, even on public land, like a lot of just little potholes and little ponds and stuff that would be like full of ducks with nobody shooting them. And so I was like, man, that'd be so cool to come out and do like a waterfowl big game combo hunt. So I talked to a friend that is one of the regional guys at DU and we pitched it to him and so yeah, we're gonna go out to Wyoming this year, shoot some and do a hunt where we're shooting ducks in the morning and then we're gonna go out and antelope hunt during the day. So I'm in the market for a new shotgun. Now, just preface this, I am partial to inertia, but I'm not dead set there. What would you recommend, or what do you guys have? And yeah, just talk to me a little bit about your shotguns.
Well, yeah, it's a huge topic because shotguns are a big portion of our business. We've talked about X bolts and rifles, which is great for us. But we got a lot of shotguns in the mix too, and probably actually more shotguns than anything. And so,
And
where
real
it comes
quick, sorry to cut you off, but like real quick too, and I think I mentioned this too, but like I grew up waterfowling and dove. That was my first thing. And I actually worked, I was the official trapper of the, it's kind of crazy. It was the Naval Air Station Oceana. And the US Navy had MWR, which stands for Morale, Welfare, and Resources, is an MWR, but open to the public, skeet and trap range with a sporting clay on the base. So I actually had keys to an air base in Virginia Beach in high school. And I would go in and open that place up and just pull and fill the machines. And I became like, I could hit 24 out of 25 on skeet like consistently. I never hit a perfect 25, unfortunately, but anyway, I have a long history with shotguns, so sorry to cut you off, but go for it.
No, that's great. And we have a large selection of trap and sporting clay guns, and typically those are the over and unders and the Satori line. And we're pretty proud of those, of course. But when it comes to waterfowl, we have three different options. Really, we have the A5 and then the Maxis 2, and then subsequent to that is the Silver, which is more of our entry-based gun. But the two main guns we run from waterfowl standpoint are the A5 and the Maxis. And as you mentioned, there's two different operating systems on those. The Maxis is a gas-operated gun. And traditionally those are a little bit lighter recoiling guns. They tend, I think the downfall of those that people try to point to is that they need a little more cleaning attention because it uses a gas system, and those gases will clog up the piston that's used in there if it's overused. But cleaning is a pretty natural consequence of anything mechanical, so that's never been an issue from my standpoint. So I like the Maxis from the standpoint that's a little bit softer recoiling. And that's the advantage to that one. Now, the other one is, of course, the A5, and that A5 is an inertia-driven gun, where we use the
Cool.
recoil of the gun to operate the action of it. And yes, technically it probably recoils a little bit more, but a lot of people go to that because it doesn't have that gas system in them. It is a cleaner running gun for sure. And so we have both options. The A5's got that nice big humpback design, and so you have a long sight plane to use if you like that look, where the Maxis has got more of the drawn out receiver, and so you have a sight plane that's a little further out in front of you. So really, we've built two different platforms, two different guns, and it does speak to two different consumers that solves their preferences. So I never take any preferences of like which one I like most, because they both operate in different functions and fit people differently and fit everybody's needs differently. I've got both, I shoot both and love them. So
Do you have a
it really
favorite?
is kind of just a personal preference.
Do you have a favorite?
I really don't. I go back and forth. I shot both this year, kind of equally. Every day I walk in and open up my gun safe and go, this one today. So I really don't have a preference. I really do enjoy them both.
Is something pretty cool and like nostalgic about that A5 though, 'cause like we have, my dad still has it, but probably one day it'll be mine, but an A5 that, gosh, I think it's like from like the 20s or 30s that like my great uncle gave my dad or something. So it's kind of a cool, like nostalgic old design that you guys, I guess you guys like re brought it back, huh?
Yeah, we ran the original Auto 5 until about 1999, I think, is when we discontinued that, and then we brought it back out in 2012. And
Nice.
it's very different from the original design, but it does carry on that heritage look of the. It is recoil operated, just a different recoil system, but it does have that signature humpback look and feel. And so, yeah, and I'm probably a little more. I've got some nostalgic feelings to that. I shot an old Auto 5 as well since I was 12.
Oh, cool.
And so like I have a sentimental attachment to that, but then I had a lot to do with the development of the Maxis too. So
Oh, nice.
I have feelings toward that one too. So I don't have a preference. They both are excellent guns. They function great and they serve two different purposes.
Yeah. Cool, man. Last thing I want to ask you about real quick, and then we'll be done, I promise.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Talk to me a little bit about Browning Ammunition, and because you guys make some killer ammo. What would you recommend for longer range big game hunting, or what do you shoot as far as your ammunition? And then maybe since I'm doing it too, same question on the waterfowl side.
We have a separate ammunition team entirely, and they'll be able to answer the details on that better than I
Okay.
will from that standpoint. But in general, like from a rifle standpoint, I have really enjoyed shooting the Long Range Pro. It's a Sierra Game King bullet. I shoot myself the 6.8 Western as my primary choice of caliber.
Cool.
It's a 175 grain bullet in that one, but I love that Long Range Pro setup. It is wildly accurate. Matter of fact, I'm looking at the target we shot yesterday. I'm looking at it's the half inch target we just shot yesterday with it, and that's pretty typical anymore. We're getting half inch groups from those rounds. So I'm a
Nice.
fan of that particular mix. And then on the waterfowl side, they have a Wicked Blend, which is a bismuth and steel blend for the waterfowl load that is just devastating. It
Nice.
really hits ducks and geese hard. You don't have triples like you do with regular steel. It's definitely worth the extra cost to shoot something a little higher end. I'm not shooting more cripples on the water, and so I don't think it's actually any more expensive. Your kill rate is definitely higher because you're hitting them harder.
Sweet. Yeah, the I haven't tried a 6.8 Western yet, but I know I talked to Chris Denham from the Western Hunter. He's kind of a, I'll say, buddy slash I look up to him kind of deal, because I think that's like the best show ever. Which, another shameless plug, I gotta say it right here, guys. I have a new airtime slot on Sportsman for season 3 at 8 p.m. on Mondays, right before the Western Hunter. So I'm excited about that. But anyway, great show, great crew over there, and he loves the 6.8 Western.
Like I said, we could do a whole episode on caliber selection, right? And probably 3 or 4 or 5 episodes
Yeah.
on it. Honestly, it goes way deep. But I would just say that when it comes to choosing a caliber, to me, the 6.8 has been the absolute all-around, all-purpose caliber that has ever been developed. And there's reasons why I think that. One, the killing power is super strong on it. We've taken everything from obviously, antelope sized stuff to all the way up to moose. Shandi, we mentioned before, she shot her moose at like 450 yards with a 6.8.
Oh, I saw that. That was with a 6.8. That thing
Yeah,
just
with a
like
6.8.
she destroyed that thing.
Yeah, and so she was in here talking actually just yesterday. We were talking about it, and she had added up. I think she is at 23 big game kills with a 6.8.
Oh, wow.
I think she probably holds the record most likely anymore, but she's killed a lot with that, and I don't, to my knowledge, there's been no hiccups. Most of them are one shot kills. Never had a rodeo. I've never had a rodeo with it in terms of having a wounded animal that you have to go chase down. It is a killing machine. It's big enough for moose and elk. It's certainly good enough for deer. And it recoils in a way that is not heavy. So most people can shoot it with ease. And my favorite part about it is that it's a short action. And I really appreciate a short action in a rifle for a variety of reasons. One, it's just a more compact receiver. It's
Lighter.
Lighter, it's stiffer receiver, and then your draw when you're cycling, it's a shorter draw, and so that short action concept of it really is appealing to me. And then the killing power is More than enough for everything. Like I said, it is a killing machine. Every guide and outfitter that we go with is starting to recommend that caliber more and more. So anyway, I know that's a shameless plug on my part. I don't care what anybody buys. You can shoot a 30-06, you can shoot a 300. And they all do a great job, but man, when it boils down to it, I'm a 6.8 Western fan across the board. It really does the job.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the same thing Chris said, just, completely off the air and on the phone with me, like not like trying to sell any certain product, but and it's pretty cool because it sounds like it's kind of that sweet spot because, I kind of like to have like one. At this point, it's easier for me to have like one rifle that kind of shoot for everything, just from an ammo standpoint and just getting stuff set up and all the stuff I got on my plate. So that's kind of why I lean towards like a bigger gun, like a 300 Win Mag or a 300 PRC or something, because I know like no matter what, even if I'm going to go shoot Cape Buffalo or something. And yes, I know you can kill anything with a 6.5 Creedmoor if you shoot it right. But I just like having a lot of gun. But at the same time, sometimes you feel like, you're shooting antelope or something. You feel like a little like, am I overgunned here? So it sounds like that 6.8 is kind of a sweet spot between having to have two rifles, like a smaller game and like an elk rifle or something. So maybe in the future I'll have to check that out. But before I let you go, what kind of cool adventures you got coming up?
Oh man, we got a couple cool things this year that we're looking forward to. We're going to try to do ptarmigan up in Alaska again this year.
Oh, fun.
It's a great one. I've got an Oregon blacktail hunt with the guys over at Leupold you mentioned
Oh,
before.
sweet.
That's on the docket for this year. Trying to still find an elk hunt somewhere to get on, and we'll do plenty of my kids have got we'll have a couple of tags this year that we'll focus on as well. And be honest, I enjoy that more than anything is watching those kids shoot some stuff, and
Oh, I bet.
they have a lot of fun. But in 2 3 weeks, I head for Spain for
Oh,
Ibex this year.
nice.
So I'm pretty excited about that trip.
Do you know where in Spain? What area?
I could look it up, but
That's
I don't
okay.
off my head, no idea. We're flying into Madrid and driving south from Madrid somewhere.
South,
So
okay. Cool. Yeah, I did Spain last year
yeah.
and very, very fun. Very cool. So
Yep, no, we're
you'll have
looking
a good
forward to
time.
that one. It'll be a good one.
All right, man. Well, I'm gonna let you go. I appreciate your time. It's been good talking to you. And where can folks go if they want to check out the X bolts or the shotguns we talked about, or
Yeah.
you?
Yeah, the easiest thing is just jump on to browning.com. Everything is right there. And then follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You get all the updates that way as well.
All right, man. Cool. Well, thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you, sir.